Welcome to Shatteredness, a program devoted to the largest segment of society. According to Gallup, there's 70% of you out there know that the world's political and religious, the world's economic, the world's media institutions, even justice systems, are corrupt, that they've become counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. We are going to, this morning, use our time to continue to dispel conspiracy theories. In our final hour today, we're going to make progress towards coming to understand why Christianity was conceived based on the poison pen of Paul. If you'd like to participate in this discussion anytime over the next 3 hours, you're encouraged to do so. It's toll-free, 877-300-7645. Answering your phone calls, screening your calls today, like yesterday. We have Randy responsible. Aaron has been reassigned, I think, during this hour. He is doing the Mary Lou Henner show, so he's gone from topics of what is happening around the world in the news to discussing which actress and actor is engaged in what kind of affair. Yesterday, I spent 2 hours trying to dissuade folks from conspiracy theory. And the thing that's important from the outset to appreciate is that there are lots of conspiracies that are well known in the news that really aren't being presented so much as conspiracies. And they aren't harebrained explanations which take credibility away from that which is obvious. That there is no problem to discuss. And in fact, I've received so many letters here in these last few days of people recognizing that, all right, LBJ, for example, conspired to hugely increase America's presence in Vietnam. He knew that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was a fake, and yet used it and continued to stand by it, was unwilling to disengage from Vietnam, costing the lives of nearly 60,000 Americans. George W. Bush knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He knew that Al-Qaeda was not involved in Iraq. He just wanted to be a wartime president because they're more popular. So he conspired to mislead the American people. It happens all the time. You know, the U.S. government conspired with Great Britain to have the Lusitania sunk so that America could engage in World War I on behalf of J.P. Morgan and banking interests. The Federal Reserve has conspired to destroy the value of your currency. There's lots of meaningful historical facts that are worth our consideration and evaluation. It's, you know, the old line of somebody saying, you know, pornography isn't good, and then somebody will say, well, why don't you define pornography for me? And he says, well, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. I think the same thing is true, really, with the conspiracy advocacy. You know, to discuss the players in the news and their motivations and their actions and the consequence of their actions, even though there are, in some cases, individuals leaguing with others that are conspiring as administrations or as Congress or as the military to mislead and manipulate. A conspiracy theorist, by the definition of what transpires here on the GCN with so many of the hosts, is to take something that is absolutely natural and appropriate, and to concoct a harebrained theory out of it for the express purpose of creating a cultish fascination with it, and claiming that your just moronic interpretation of events is somehow truthful. A great example is chemtrails. the notion that the chemtrails, they aren't chemtrails, the condensation trails that you see coming from the back of airplanes are somehow part of a government plot to poison you is so utterly stupid. And yet so popular amongst conspiracy theorists that that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Taking an ordinary phenomenon, which is the byproduct of the combustion product, which process, which is water, and the natural state of water when it is superheated in a cold environment, creating a constant condensation, the kind of things you see in clouds coming out of the backs of engines, and promoting the myth that that's the government trying to poison you is an example of stupidity taken to a cultish fascination. Well, so is building 7 of the World Trade Center. The World Trade Center started with the idiocy of conspiracy theorists claiming that that the Twin Towers themselves weren't actually blown up by Muslims screaming Allahu Akbar, that it had nothing to do with the plot that Ramzi Youssef had conceived in the Philippines, that it was the government who changed, edited all the video that was independently taken to make it seem like airplanes flew into the buildings, and they said that the building's beams were covered in thermite. And once all of those things were vociferously and articulately disproved, they finally all resonated on Building 7, and that now is sort of the home of the conspiracy theorists. That's their favorite topic. I know they like genetically modified organisms as if there is a food that is not genetically modified by man. And they like their fixation with fluoride in the water, which has nothing to do, I guess, with tooth decay. It has all to do with a plot by government to kill you. And they like all manner of Jews control the media, Jews control banking, Jews are bad, Jews are, you know, plotting to overthrow the world. But you get right down to it now, the favorite layer of and lie of the conspiracy theorists is Building 7 of the World Trade Center. So I began yesterday to tell you who built it, why it was built, and I'm going to pick up where we left off in the second hour yesterday. It was in June of 1986. Before construction was completed, that the managers of and financiers of World Trade Center 7, and it was called World Trade Center 7 because it was just the seventh building built on the World Trade Center complex. It's a very small building, actually, and extremely narrow. That they signed Drexel Burnham Lambert as a tenant to lease the entire building of World Trade Center 7, the entire building, for $3 billion over a term of 30 years. In December of 1986, however, the Boesky insider trading scandal brought Drexel Burnham Lambert down, causing them to cancel their lease, leaving Silverstein, which was the manager of the project, to find other tenants. Spencer and Oppenheim agreed to lease 14% of the space, but for more than a year, as Black Monday and other factors adversely affected the lower Manhattan real estate market, Silverstein was unable to find tenants for the remaining space. By April of 1988, they had lowered the rent and made many other concessions. In November of 1988, Solomon Brothers withdrew from plans to build their own large new complex at Columbus Circle in Midtown, New York, and they agreed to a 20-year lease for the top 19 floors of 7 World Trade Center. They were the dominant tenant in the building, occupying, as I say, the top 19 floors. The building was extensively renovated for them in 1989 to accommodate their specific needs. 9 diesel generators were installed on the 5th floor as part of a backup power station. Essentially, Solomon was constructing a building within a building And its occupation of the building at the time they were doing it complicated the situation. There were many compromises made, particularly structural. At the time of September 11, 2001, when 19 Muslims, mostly Saudi Arabians, screaming Allahu Akbar, fundamentalist Muslims, as suicide bombers flew two 757s into each of the two towers, one 757 into each tower, two towers, two airplanes. Solomon Smith Barney was by far the biggest tenant in 7 World Trade Center, occupying 1,200,000 square feet, 64% of the building, which included floors 28 through 45. Other major tenants included Hartford Insurance, American Express, Standard Chartered Bank, Security and Exchange Commission, Internal Revenue Service, the United States Secret Service, which protects the president, the New York City Office of Emergency Management, and the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the Federal Home Loan Bank, the Provident Financial Management Company, Immigration and Naturalization Services, Department for New York anyway, the Department of Defense had a office there, and the Central Intelligence Agency shared some offices with the IRS. The North Tower, as we know, collapsed. And the reason I show you that list is that it's important to know who was there, because the conspiracy theorists would have you believe that the government purposely brought down the building so as to destroy some files of some agency, when the dominant tenants were financial companies, nothing to do with any kind of conspiracy or cover-up. All of their files backed up at other places. As the North Tower collapsed on September 11, 2001, heavy debris hit 7 World Trade Center, damaging the south face of the building. It also started fires that continued to burn throughout the day. This is what I had thought had brought down World Trade Center, was the 7, was that it was damaged when the other buildings collapsed. But we'll continue and learn the facts in a moment. So as the North Tower collapsed, September 11th, 2001, early in the morning, heavy debris hit 7 World Trade Center. The gashes on its side, some of the gashes are 10 stories long, jarred the building, dislodged many of its internal structural mounts. But it was ultimately into fires. And the fire started to burn throughout the afternoon. The collapse also caused, this is of the North Tower, it was adjacent to the North Tower, shared garages, shared loading and shipping ramps with the North Tower. The collapse also caused damage to the southwest corner between floors 7 and 17. And the south face between floor 44 and the roof. There were gouges, huge impact craters, up and down and all around, all three of the four sides of World Trade Center 7. Because the building, the North Tower, loomed so close and so high above it. There was another vertical gash near the center of the south face of the building between floors 24 and 41. The building was hugely compromised by these impacts. Now, the building was equipped, World Trade Center 7, with a sprinkler system, but it had many single-point vulnerabilities for failure. The sprinkler system required manual initiation of the electrical fire pumps rather than being set to be in an automatic system. And, of course, with electricity compromised and water pressure hugely compromised by the ruptures and breaks that occurred as a result of the two towers adjacent to it, the pumps were never turned on. And so the controls, in conjunction with the sprinkler system inside of the building, weren't activated. And the sprinklers system required power for the fire pump to deliver water, which that connection was severed. What little water did flow through some of the systems was way too low in pressure to even feed the sprinklers and have them work. So after the North Tower collapsed, some firefighters entered 7 World Trade Center to search the building. They attempted to extinguish small pockets of fire, but low water pressure hindered their efforts all the more. Over the course of the day, fires burned out of control on several floors of the World Trade Center. The flames were visible on the east side of the building. During the afternoon, fire was also seen on floors 6 through 10, on floors 13 through 14, on floors 19 through 22, and on floors 29 and 30. So there were 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 floors of the building that were engulfed in fire. And no way to put it out. In particular, the fires on floors 7 through 9 and 11 through 13 continued to burn completely out of control throughout the afternoon. At approximately 2 p.m., firefighters noticed a bulge in the southwest corner of 7 World Trade Center between the 10th and 13th floors, where the fires were raging the hottest. It was a sign that the building was unstable and might soon collapse. During the afternoon, firefighters also heard creaking sounds coming from the building. Around 3:30, the fire department of New York Chief Daniel Nigro decided to halt all rescue operations, all surface removal and searches along the surface debris and around 7 World Trade Center, and evacuate the area due to concerns for the safety of his personnel. At 5:20 and 33 seconds p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, the building started to collapse. With the crumple of the East Mechanical Penthouse, that was the first thing that failed. It collapsed completely. There were no casualties associated with this collapse. In May of 2002, the Federal Energy Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, issued a report on the collapse based upon a preliminary investigation conducted jointly with Structural Engineering Institute and the American Society of Civil Engineers. In May 2002, it's 6-7 months after the twin bombings by fundamentalist Muslims, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, issued a report on the collapse of World Trade Center 7 and a preliminary investigation conducted jointly with the Structural Engineering Institute of America, Civil and Society of Civil Engineers. And in their preliminary report, in cooperation with the American Society of Civil Engineers, they found that the collapse was not primarily caused by the actual impact damage from the collapse of one WTC or two WTC, but instead by the fires on multiple stories and how those fires ignited from debris from the other two towers continued to burn unabated due to a lack of water for the sprinklers system and for the manual firefighting efforts. The collapse began when a critical internal column buckled and triggered the structural failure throughout the building. That's what FEMA and the American Society of Civil Engineers, upon their investigation of the evidence, found in May of 2002. Turns out they were right. Subsequently, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, the NIST, was authorized to lead an investigation into the structural failure and collapse of the World Trade Center. And it's not only its twin towers, but also 7 World Trade Center. The investigation was led by Dr. Shyam Sunder. And it drew upon in-house technical expertise as well as the knowledge of several outside private institutions, including the Structural Engineering Institute of the American Society of Civil Engineers, the Society of Fire Prevention and Protection Engineers, the National Fire Protection Association, the American Institute of Steel Construction, the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, and the Structural Engineers Association of New York. So here you have a team set up of those individuals who should know more about this than anyone. Now, I know that doesn't compare with some nincompoop exchanging their opinions and stating their opinions as if they were facts, to tantalize the ears and eyeballs of conspiracy theorists. But the National Institute of Standards and Technology, a reputable, independent organization, was assigned the task of verifying and affirming why the building fell. And they elicited the involvement of the American Society of Civil Engineers, the Society of Fire Protection Engineers, the National Fire Protection Association, the American Institute of Steel Construction, the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, and the Structural Engineers Association of New York. The NIST provided a preliminary report about 7 World Trade Center in June of 2004, and thereafter released updates on their investigation. In November of 2008, they released their final report on the causes of the collapse of 7 World Trade Center. And the reason that it was in 2008 after the 2004 preliminary report was because the towers 1 and 2 were so much more devastating in terms of the loss. And it was so much more important to ascertain specifically how the chain of events of airplanes flying to those buildings eventually brought them down. And so they devoted most of their resources to World Trade Center 1 and 2, and a lesser amount of resources to 7. And then once 1 and 2's investigation was completed, they associated everything back with the completion of the investigation of World Trade Center 7. Natural, appropriate. This followed the NIST's August 21, 2008 draft report, which included a period for public comments. In its investigation, the NIST analyzed ANSYS to model events leading up to the collapse initiation and LSDYNA models to simulate the global response to the initiating events. Now, what it, ANSYS and LSDYNA are computer modeling tools. My son, and I've shared this with many of you, my eldest son, is a aerospace engineer. He designs jet engines for General Electric. And General Electric designs and models and tests all of its engines in computer modeling, something that they actually invented and have perfected. Today, most engineering is based on computer modeling. And the computer models are extraordinarily effective at accurately predicting how components of any large system are going to react. And then when they actually make the product, they test it in the real world, and then they analyze the results of real-world testing against their computer models and adjust the computer models so that they even more accurately predict the future outcome of a engineered system. that's what these folks did as well. It's a huge part now of engineering. It's the driving future, the driving preponderance that is linked to the future of engineering. There's very little now engineering tests that are done in with physical product. Almost all of it now is simulated on computers. Anyway, they ran these tests to determine the global response of all the component systems within the events to the environment that they were brought to bear against, particularly the fires. The NIST determined that the diesel fuel stored in the basement of the building did not play an important role, mainly because diesel fuel requires a lot to ignite it. You can make a diesel fuel bomb, which is explosive, but one of the advantages of diesel fuel, unlike gasoline, unlike kerosene, kerosene, which was on the jet's wings, it's explosive to a spark. Diesel typically is not explosive to a spark, and they're saying that the diesel fuel stored in the basement, while if it had actually caught fire, would have been disastrous, but it was not a contributing factor. Did not play an important role, which is what they said. Nor did the structural damage from the collapse of the World Trade Center. The 4 or 5, 10-story slashes and gashes on the outside of the building, they said, wasn't helpful, but that did not play the major role in the collapse of Building 7. Nor did the transfer elements, the trusted girders or cantilevered overhangs. Remember I shared with you yesterday that World Trade Center 7 was cantilevered over a Con Edison power station, and that the cantilevered approach and the power station trusses and caissons were all designed to for a building to be built that was one-third of the overall mass of World Trade Center 7. So the foundation of the building was inadequate to support the building should there be any abnormal stress or shock on the building. And yet, that was not the primary cause of the collapse. Would it have collapsed because of that eventually? Perhaps. Could the fuel in the basement have eventually caught fire and caused the building to collapse? Perhaps. But neither were the primary contributors, nor were the gashes of falling debris and the impact on the sides of the building. Ultimately, they said that the lack of water to fight the fire was the most important factor. The fires burned out of control during the afternoon, causing floor beams near column 79 to expand and to push a key girder off of its seat, triggering the floors to fail around column 79 on floors 8 through 14. That was the cause. With a large loss of lateral support across 9 floors, column 79 buckled, pulling the east penthouse and nearby columns down with it. With the buckling of those central columns, the collapse then progressed east to west across the core, ultimately overloading the perimeter support, which buckled between floors 7 and 17, causing the remaining portion of the building above to fall downward as a single unit. The fires fueled by office contents, along with a lack of water, were the key contributors to this collapse. We have Glenn on the line who has a comment on Building 7. All sounds so clear, so reasonable, so well determined and explained. Hopefully you're not going to argue with all of these agencies and their but firms.
Well, I am going to. I'm sitting here. I can hear certain objections being raised by their side. So I was going
to
fire.
Oh, okay, you've got an ear to the objectors. you like to play devil's advocate. It's one of your favorites.
Well, I prefer the term contrarian because.
Okay. Yeah, I understand. And by the way, most of the time, just for our listeners. Most of the time, Glenn plays contrarian. He does not concur with what he's going to say. He just wants to see if we all have a way of explaining away the contrarian comments.
Well, and, yeah, and, just and as a historical note, a Catholic church in its theological debates used to have a priest dress up as the devil
mm-hmm.
to play the devil's advocate in debate as a means supposedly of truth testing, you know, doctrines and arguments. Not that they necessarily got to the truth, but that was like part of the shtick.
Have you ever seen the movie Devil's Advocate, speaking of the devil's advocate?
Oh, man, not the whole thing, but... very scary stuff.
I probably watched that movie 10 times because Al Pacino's portrayal of the devil as anything other than the devil is so accurate in terms of how Satan operates. I thought it was one of the greatest acting jobs I have ever seen, and one of the greatest attempts at framing a known character through dialogue. We'll be back in a moment. Back to Shatteringness. We've got Glenn in the position, not of Devil's Advocate, even though he also enjoys the movie under that title, but instead as contrarian on the finding of the American Society of Civil Engineers. So what do you have you to say to contradict their... long and thorough investigation and their expertise on this subject?
Okay, well, first of all, before I go into contradiction, I'd like to point out that there's a third option, and that given the circumstances of who I am, where I am, and what I do and don't know, and I have two sides saying that unless I believe their arguments, I'm an idiot who believes lies, I would suggest that epistemologically speaking, it's reasonable for me to say I can't really obtain certainty about these matters. And given that my opinion about the situation, the important details of these situations, isn't worth a tinker's damn, it's reasonable for someone to say, I really can't come to a reasonable conclusion on this because I really don't have any way of looking all this stuff up and checking it. So you could say it's a cowardly thing, but even if discretion is sometimes the better part of valor, I would just suggest that it's reasonable for someone to say, I'm not really certain.
Okay, all right. Now, let's deal with that. I am not a civil engineer. I have not read the entire report, either one of the two reports that systematically analyzed the collapse of the building and came to the same conclusion that this column buckled. So, have I checked out all the details? No. Do I know a fair amount about the American Society of Engineers? Yes. My youngest son is an engineer. My eldest son's an engineer, develops jet engines for GE. And my youngest son started in engineering. He's now a chemist. So I've been exposed to a fair amount of it. I'm an architect for fun. That's one of my favorite pastimes is architecture. And I love system design. I can read this and say, well, all of that makes a great deal of sense. That's all very logical. And I'm not going to claim that I know that I'm as schooled as these individuals are in the American Society of Civil Engineers in these subjects. When it comes to trusting a comprehensive investigation by the most competent, independent team of people to explain something that they know more about than anyone in the world, unless there is a glaring problem of evidence and reason that I am aware of that they have somehow neglected.
Right.
I'm not in a position where I would ever state my opinion over theirs. Am I comfortable with these findings? Yeah, I'm comfortable with these findings. That's a completely rational explanation by very well-educated and informed people.
Yeah, but you've had the time and taken the time to look. I'm talking about from the standpoint of you know, the talk radio listener, the TV watcher who's
yes.
paying the mortgage and taking care of two kids and keeping the cars on the road and the thing. Doesn't have time to go work.
They wouldn't even have, they would not have read or considered what we just considered.
Right. But, now for the two objections that I'm hearing in my head are,
okay.
but I saw the video of the BBC announcer who pronounced the collapse of Building 7 25 minutes before it happened with a clear video picture of the building still standing over her right shoulder. And there's that one. And I saw the video of Larry Silverstein saying, oh, there had been so much, you know, death and destruction, and it was so risky that we just decided to pull the building. You know, and I saw the video of the guy with the walkie-talkie was playing the countdown and waving people back from the scene. Okay, I mean, the most compelling one is Silverstein saying, we decided just to pull the building.
Well, they did decide to pull the building in the sense that they decided to give up on it. They decided to give up on it.
Now the argument is, pull the building is a specific,
pull the building in there, pull their, pull does not mean demolition. It doesn't mean demolition in anybody's vocabulary. We're going to pull the building, which means that we're going to pull all resources away from that building. We're not going to have firefighters in that building because they're going to die. That building is going to collapse. I'm not going to have anyone in that building. We're not going to apply any resources. We're going to pull all resources away from that building so that we don't add to the death toll. That's what it means. And it's really clear. And to suggest that means that we're going to go into a building that's ablaze and we're going to detonate it. We're going to bring in explosives. I mean, that would be stupid.